Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show here on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm very, very excited about the way in which we are starting this week's morning show. We're speaking today with a woman by the name of Christy Wilson. One of the things you should know about her is she's an ardent listener to the morning show, but way beyond that, the reason she is on the morning show today is because she has created a really extraordinary industry undertaking called Sweet Impact, Confections with a Conscience. We're going to be talking about chocolate and about widespread concerns about rampant child trafficking in the cocoa industry. And unfortunately, the relatively cheap price of most of the chocolate that we buy in supermarkets and consume without thinking is so cheap in part because of these kind of deplorable practices which occur where chocolate is grown. So this is an opportunity for you to consume delicious chocolate which circumvents all of those unfortunate practices. And it is in part an effort to draw attention to some of those practices and to see if maybe some real and lasting systemic change can be enacted. So anyway, Christy Wilson's work is under the banner of Sweet Impact, and we're going to be talking today with her about how she got this off the ground, what prompted her to have these concerns. We'll talk more specifically about some of the concerns that do surround the cocoa industry and the efforts that are already underway to try to do something about that. And I have sitting in front of me some delicious-looking samples from Sweet Impact, which she has brought with her to our WGTD studios. Christy Wilson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Great to have you here. I'm so happy we can do this. So let's take ourselves back to the very, very beginning. First of all, maybe say a word about your own love affair with chocolate, with fudge, with this whole thing, and then we'll dig into some of the specific issues which prompted you to create Sweet Impact.
Well, it might surprise you that I don't actually enjoy fudge much.
Oh.
but this fudge recipe that I was given was one that was not at all like anything I'd ever had in terms of fudge. And in fact, it's different enough that we had to start calling it something different because most of the people that are big fans of it said, yeah, this isn't fudge. and I kept going, but there's nothing else I can call it. I don't know what other name to give it. We don't have a confection category for it.
Hmm.
And after I took the professional chocolatier course this last winter, I realized, oh, this is like the inside of a truffle. And so that's why we started calling them naked truffles.
Naked truffles.
Yes. Wow. No shell.
So where did this recipe come from or from whom?
Actually, and that's one of my favorite stories about all of this. My best friend for many, many, many years, her mom, her name was Linda Lundeen. She lived in Airdrie, Alberta, which is right near Calgary. And she had been doing this fudge recipe, which she didn't share with anybody. She'd been selling it for years and years and years to support charities up there. She would sell it at a craft store or at craft shows and things. And when she passed away then in 2012 from stomach cancer, it was very sudden. The family wasn't really prepared for that. She'd given me the recipe when I got married, but I had to agree to never sell it. And so when she passed away, her daughter said, absolutely, you can do this with it. Mom would be thrilled. So I rather took it and ran with it.
I guess so. So part of what has prompted you to do all of this important work is because of some of the deep concerns that you and others have about the professional chocolate industry or cocoa industry. And at what point did that become something that you were directly aware of, and where does that fit into the timeline here?
I think in about 2010, I started seeing articles circulated talking about issues with cocoa production, with cocoa growing, issues with child labor involved in it, child trafficking, but it never became mainstream. And so for me, it was, okay, this is interesting. I'm going to try to change my purchasing practices, but I'm not entirely sure what else I can do, and I didn't know enough about it. And then some really important documentaries were made that came out about it. CNN started doing some reporting about it in their, they have a modern day slavery sort of section of their research reporting. They started doing some documentaries on it. But then the most important work that came out was done by Mickey Mastrati and his partner in documentary crime, sort of friend, who they did a documentary called The Shady Side of Chocolate and The Dark Side of Chocolate, two different ones. And within it, basically, they took the opportunity to get in to the Ivory Coast. And then they also took the opportunity to investigate various chocolate companies that are headquartered in Europe that we don't necessarily realize that a lot of our chocolate companies here are actually attached to. So they came at it from the European side of things and did a ton of on-the-ground research investigation and really pointed out the fact that this wasn't some small isolated issue. This is heavily intensive. And the industry has known about it since 2000. In fact, our government knew about it in 2000 and put together the Harkin-Engel Protocol. So there have been things going on at higher reaches that we as consumers don't necessarily hear about. We aren't really face-to-face with it very much. So at that point, I started getting really passionate about it. My kids kind of got annoyed because I started changing what we were purchasing at home. They were, in fact, my son, probably about 2 years into the Sweet Impact thing, said, so am I ever going to get a Snickers or a Milky Way, Mom? I'm like, okay, hon, let's talk about that. but then by starting Sweet Impact, it gave me an avenue to dig in. It gave me a voice to start contacting some of these other organizations that were really active in it and trying to raise awareness. And that just kind of ballooned.
You tell a story on your website about how the church you were attending at the time had some kind of justice store. And I suspect some of our listeners can have seen the same sort of thing maybe at their own churches where goods will be sold that are fair trade items. And tell us more about how that helped to be kind of a catalyst for all this.
For me, the idea of recognizing that what we often have at a very discounted price, and somebody else is paying that price. When we had the opportunity at our church to have fair trade organizations in selling goods that were directly helping people that were in communities where the cycle of poverty was being broken by that, that was profound. But one of the organizations that really got me excited was Origin Coffee out in California. And they run a cafe entirely by volunteers, and their goal was to raise money to help the organizations that are actually working to rescue trafficking victims in Southeastern Asia and in Eastern Europe that are specifically in the sex industry. And the entire program they've done, they use fair trade coffee. They have all volunteers working in the stores and running it. And so the amount they're able to give then is profound. And so I started asking, is there any way I could do that with chocolate?
And so what you do, and we'll dig into the details in a little bit later. So what you do is create chocolate, delicious chocolate treats that are not part of this sort of standard production cycle.
Correct.
And so how is that ensured?
Yeah, it's a good question. Primarily, I only use chocolates that are fair trade certified, organic certified, or Rainforest Alliance certified. All three of those external certification agencies have strict no child labor policies. It's not just no child trafficking, it's no child labor. And that's a huge deal. But then the secondary thing that I use as a precaution is almost all of my chocolate comes from Central, South America, and the Caribbean. So most of it comes from Peru, from Ecuador, from the Dominican Republic. I've gotten some from Colombia. So those in those places, that's where chocolate is native. We oftentimes forget that the countries where we're getting most of our chocolate from isn't where chocolate originated. Mm. So chocolate originated entirely in that area right around the equator that is rainforest areas. So it was native in Mexico. It was native in lots of Central America and primarily in mountain areas in South America. So the environment it grows in is entirely hospitable to it, which makes a big difference in their yields and in what they have to do to get good crops. They don't have to go to the same lengths in terms of pesticides, in terms of fertilizers, any of that, because it's been growing in these climates in a very biodiverse, I guess might be the right word, I'm not sure, sort of area, whereas so, Africa's not its native climate.
So in a sense, it's better to get it where it was meant to grow versus where it is, in a sense, being imposed on the landscape in places where that are, in a sense, less hospitable to it.
Yes.
Fascinating. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Christy Wilson, who is responsible for, I guess we would call it a home business called Sweet Impact, Confections with a Conscience. And she creates wonderful chocolate, but she is circumventing the standard sort of production cycle of the chocolate that most of us purchase and consume on a regular basis, the kind of things you find in the supermarket. There are some really sad realities about how much of that chocolate is procured. And so when you are purchasing something from Sweet Impact, you know that you are purchasing, in a sense, pristine chocolate that is not tainted with some of these unhappy realities. Christy Wilson, let's talk for a moment about how chocolate is made. And it's interesting, you mentioned in passing that you've taken some kind of confectioner's course, and so you know a whole lot more about this than most of us do. Take us through kind of the standard life cycle, let's say, of a standard piece of chocolate. I mean, where does all of this begin with what kind of plant, and in general, at least, what is the process by which that becomes something delicious to eat?
Well, I'll skip the scientific names because I'm pretty sure that I've only read them and not heard them pronounced properly. But there are three main varieties of cocoa trees that almost all the chocolate we consume comes from. And they've been around, I believe, chocolate. My goodness, it goes back to, I think the first recorded ones that we have of guaranteed consumption of chocolate was easily 2,000 plus years ago. So, you're talking about something that grows in a rainforest. It grows in giant pods, best way that most people have probably seen it, maybe didn't even recognize it, but they've seen it around. It grows in a pod, and then inside, when they cut them open, once they're ripe, they have to be harvested down from the trees. That's one thing that most people don't necessarily recognize is they're quite a bit up high, and it takes hand harvesting. So you're not talking about a product that they can go through with a harvester or anything and just do it all by machine. So it's cut down. The beans are pulled out of the pods. There's actually fruit within the pod that, within some cultures, that's part of they consuming it. But then the beans are pulled out. They're dried. They are fermented. They are ground then into a paste. The paste is then combined in a variety of different ways, depending on who's crafting it, into what we consider chocolate. You can add milk. You don't have to add milk. You can add sugar. You don't have to add sugar. It depends on what degree of cocoa intensity you're looking at. But most of the time when a local crafter like I'm doing, when we get it in what's called coviture, which would be a huge bulk production of the type of chocolate we want to work with, be it unsweetened or whatever variety of trees we're working with. There are some crafters that actually do bean to bar crafting, which is really fascinating work. I don't have the equipment yet for that. But they will go and they'll make arrangements with individual farms to produce and or to purchase their beans, and then they will do all of that work of the roasting and grinding and everything.
Oh,
on
I
their
see.
Own.
So the way you are doing this with Sweet Impact is somebody else has already done that. So you are sort of taking this cocoa at a different point in its life cycle.
Exactly.
Interesting. So we have these huge pods. They're up in the trees.
Yes.
So they have to be hand harvested. These pods are taken down. You said there's fruit within these pods, and then these cocoa beans are within those fruits.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you broke it open, you'd see a color shell. Depending on the tree, it's different colors.
Oh.
The shell, when it's ripe, can be anywhere from red to yellow to orangish golds, kind of colors in between. If it is cut open, sliced down the middle, you'd see all the white flesh, and then you'd see all the beans inside. And they have to get all of that flesh off. And, yeah, it's an edible substance for a lot of cultures. South America, most of the native peoples in that area that are doing chocolate production now, that's always been historically part of their diet, too.
Interesting.
So
are there vastly different varieties of cocoa plants, or generally speaking, are they largely the same?
Chocolate is actually kind of like fine wine. We tend to be used to chocolate always kind of tasting the same. If you're getting milk chocolate, you know what you're getting. If you're getting dark chocolate, you know what you're getting. When you start branching out into chocolates that are grown in different soil, that are grown in different climates, you get entirely different palates to the chocolate. I've done a chocolate tasting with a group that I needed to do for my class and said, okay, you need to kind of figure out what else you're tasting. It's not just chocolate. There's other flavors in there. And some of them are so pronounced, people are convinced something's been added to it. I'm like, no, that's just the difference in that species of tree. There's even a section of the Amazon that grows a certain kind of one of the species of trees that in that soil it is so well known that that is a world-famous chocolate because it comes from that small region. So, yeah, there's differences in the species of trees and how they've, you know, bred together in the jungles and stuff. But also then there's a difference in the climate and the soil in what happens to the flavor of the chocolate.
Wow. So the kind of material that you get that starts the process then for you is exactly what then? What do you receive in the mail and what does it look like?
I get it from a bulk importer that does. And one of the reasons I like them so much is they work specifically with a lot of local chocolate manufacturers in different regions of the world. So I'm able to get product that most of us would never find in the average store or even in the average restaurant supply sort of place.
Mm-hmm.
I get giant 22-pound boxes, containers, full of what's called coviture, and it looks like a small disc that then, and it's all uniform so that I can make, you know, whether it's bonbons that are coated with the chocolate, whether it's solid chocolates, I think I brought some for you, that I temper it down because anytime you touch chocolate in a heat way, you change its temper. And that's the first thing they make you learn in chocolate school. is that if you do that, you better know what to do with it once you've heated it. So there's all these different stages depending on the chocolate manufacturer, depending on the type of chocolate you're working with, how dark it is, or if it's white chocolate. You have to take it to different temperatures to get it back into that shiny temper where it's firm and crisp and it's going to hold its texture for a long time.
And you can work with it then. Mm-hmm. So are these little discs?
Mm-hmm.
And are they brown? I mean, if we saw them, would we
think? Well, the white chocolates aren't.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, because white chocolate isn't chocolate. But yeah, it would look like a little button without any holes. Would be the best way to describe it. Little flat discs. Now, some of my chocolate actually comes in big blocks, too. The stuff that I get from the Dominican Republic comes in blocks, and I have to chop it all down. Mm. So
good exercise.
Exactly.
You mentioned earlier that all of the product with which you work is certified in three different areas. And actually, that's even beyond the fact of no child labor being involved in any of this. Mm-hmm. That's, in a sense, a given with this particular supplier. But there are these three other certifications which are significant for you, and I suspect would be significant for a lot of people, a lot of our listeners who have concerns about the environment. So remind us of what those certifications are. Explain what they are.
The first one would be certified organic. You can get USDA certification organic, and you can also get then there's global organic certifications. One of the reasons I look for those is because it's outside. Any company could tell me that they certify that it's organic.
Right. They themselves.
Right.
Which means nothing.
Exactly. And so I look for ones that have had an outside agency coming in and checking. The other one is fair trade certified. And the last
one. So that means in terms of who is profiting from this. And can you explain more what that designation really means?
Industries, each kind of industry probably has a slightly different way they negotiate this. But for chocolate, there's a market price for cocoa beans. That goes up and down like crazy. And most of it then tends to be, obviously, whoever's going to sell it to me for the lowest price is what businesses are looking for. Fair trade guarantees to the partnering farms, the partnering producers, that they're going to guarantee this wage. It's sometimes going to be way beyond whatever the lowest market is. Other times the market might actually come approaching it. But they're going to guarantee to a farmer, you're going to have a steady income. We're always going to guarantee to you it's going to be above the market fluctuations. And that means, and yes, they have to pay a fee. That's one of the things I don't know that a lot of people recognize, is that if a farm, if any kind of production facility gets that certification, they had to pay a fee to cover the agents that come in and license them, that come in and inspect everything. So it's not cheap to the farmers, but it's obviously got to have enough of a benefit to obviously make it worth it for them. So that's kind of a huge deal.
Sure.
Then within, you know, other organic has their own rules that they need to follow. Rainforest Alliance, same thing. There's different rules that they're going to expect them to be conforming to for environmental issues, sustainability, that sort of thing.
Right. And what about that third certification involving the rate? I didn't quite catch the term.
Have you heard of Rainforest Alliance?
Well, I guess in general I have.
Okay.
But
yeah, they do a lot of certifications, even of clothing products where like cotton is being harvested or things that specifically are relating to rainforest health. I think most of us have started to become familiar with the idea that the rainforests themselves are an enormous effect on our environment, on climate change, that sort of thing. They guarantee that the people that are producing stuff in within that are observing practices that are protecting species, that are reducing greenhouse gases, are reducing a variety of things that would potentially impact the rainforest.
Right. So in other words, we know then that this chocolate has not been procured in such a way that does undue damage to the rainforest,
exactly,
to that habitat.
Mm-hmm.
So these three certifications are all bound up in this.
Mm-hmm.
What I think we haven't yet talked about sufficiently, and it's in a sense the heart and soul of why this mission means so much to you, is the reality of child labor and even child trafficking that is such a significant part of the more standard cocoa industry or chocolate industry. So where are we talking about this being an especially serious problem? And in what kind of way are children in a sense, used in an abusive way in this industry?
One of the things, there's two countries that most of our chocolate comes from, the Ivory Coast and Ghana. You're talking about countries that have had a even recent history, a very unstable environment in terms of law enforcement, in terms of government stability, that sort of thing. Ghana's made a ton of progress in that particular arena. But when it comes to cocoa farmers, they are dealing on a sub-poverty level when it comes to living conditions. And one of the things that folks that are experts in poverty, in how do we break those cycles, one of the things they keep going back to is you'll never get a culture out of that society until they have a chance to make a living wage. So you have people that are desperate, people that are pretty much willing to do anything to try to feed whoever's in their family. When you're in that climate, then children become either resources that you can use to hopefully put food on the table, or they are an extra burden potentially. And if somebody promises to you that if your child comes and comes with me, I've got a school I can put them in. If you pay, I mean, the ironic thing is there's parents that will pay a small amount out of what they've got to try to get their kid into this school, unknowing the fact, without knowing that that child's going to end up on somebody's cocoa plantation hundreds of miles away. And the borders, especially of the Ivory Coast, are incredibly porous. You have, my memory's not serving me right on the map exactly, but there's at least five countries that butt up against this tiny, tiny area. And within that, you're not talking about borders like we're used to seeing on a highway or something. People traffic these kids on motorcycles. They'll run them through the jungle. They don't have to even go through a check stop. So the process of helping communities in those agencies understand what's happening to their kids is huge.
So in other words, some parents at least have no idea the fate of their own children.
No.
That they are, in a sense, signing them away for this kind of life, not realizing it. They're maybe hoping that they will enjoy some better life.
Exactly. They think they're giving their kid a chance to improve. You'll have children that are picked up off the street and promised, you know, you come work for me, I'll give you a bike. You can, you know, whatever. When you start looking at the average age of children, the average age of a child in the cocoa industry right now is 10. The ages of Tulane University has been doing for many years now an ongoing collaborative research project with our U.S. Department of Child Labor, Child Welfare, actually maybe is the right term, the International Labor Organization, UNICEF, and governments in the Ivory Coast and Ghana. And they've been going in since, I want to say 2007 was their first year. And they've been doing annual reports. And every year it gets more extensive. Every year they're able to get farther in. And they've been tracking all of the rates of child labor. And they do it in different categories. They're looking at child labor overall. They're looking at hazardous labor for children. They're looking at average ages. They're looking at where the kids are coming from, what home countries they came from. They're looking at wages for cocoa producers compared to industry profits. It's extensive. Ghana's made some good headway. But the statistic I use to try to consolidate it for my customers when I'm talking to them about this is that when you look at the kids ages 5 to 11 that are doing what is categorized by the ILO as hazardous labor, there's more of them currently just in the Ivory Coast than the entire population of Miami. And that statistic, when I started looking at it, I mean, we're talking several hundred thousand kids working with machetes every day. They're spreading pesticide and fertilizer without any protection. So we're talking about chemicals that we're afraid to potentially consume in our own food if it's ever been sprayed on a field. They're spraying those chemicals. And they aren't given so much as a mask.
Wow.
So you're talking about kids that end up with severe injuries from using machetes. I mean, if you look at a 6-year-old or 7-year-old, Most of them are the size of our four-year-olds. Their nutrition is incredibly scarce. Many of them are barely fed there. And all this is not just something I'm this isn't worst case scenario kind of, this is what is the norm. And so they have injuries from machetes. They have systemic organ issues from working with all of those chemicals. It's profound what it does to them.
Wow. Do we know think about how long the average child is engaged in this? I mean, are we talking about children who are away from their own homes for years?
Yes. Yes. They don't have specific numbers, but yeah, they are in there until they become useless or they are able to escape. Some of them end up in indentured servitude sorts of situations. When we talk about trafficking, I know this has been talked about in some other industries, but they come in and they are told they have a debt to pay because they were transported to this wonderful job. And so any wages that they pay, or they would be paid, in quotations, ends up being applied to their burden, their financial burden, their lodging, their whatever food they do get, the getting in there. So it's a really complicated system. And I find one of my problems is it's easy to look at it and go, well, why don't you just do this? Why doesn't the child just do this? And then I start to think, would my 10-year-old have known how to handle a situation
right.
like that?
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, to be thrust into this situation where adults are perhaps persuasive or formidable or in whatever way, the kind of people you don't argue with. And wow, this is disturbing indeed. So it's Ghana and Ivory Coast that to provide most of the world's chocolate. Now, are we talking about then the most familiar names in terms of what we find in the supermarket? Are these companies that are complicit in the sense of purchasing this without asking enough questions?
Again, the chocolate companies have known and admitted to this publicly, internationally, in the year 2000. They signed off, the heads of all the major companies that we would think of when it comes to chocolate, they all signed off on the Harkin-Engel Protocol, which was a promise by them to eradicate, now it was voluntary, a promise by them that they would voluntarily eradicate child labor in their practices by the year 2008. The documents are there still. Their signatures are on them. They didn't make it, obviously. In fact, the problem in the Ivory Coast has gotten worse in recent years. The last report from Tulane came out of the 2013-2014 harvest. And so the numbers were actually worse there. It had improved some in Ghana. They have continuously put out, when the heat gets put on by us as consumers who start to advocate, they will put out promises on the websites of what their new goals are. The latest goals right now are that it's going to be, they said they would reduce all of the trafficking by all of the child labor by 70% by the year 2020. According to Tulane, there's no way they're going to make that. They just don't have the infrastructure put in place. And so, yeah, they've known about it. And the line that keeps coming up is, it's complex. We can't fix it. It's complicated. But those that work in the industry, those that are there on the ground, and those that are working in the government agencies that's kind of supervise and keep tabs on all this, one of the biggest issues is you have to pay cocoa farmers a fair wage. They've got to be able to live, because and this continues to be an issue. When you see any country with chronic poverty issues like this, or where human life becomes so disposable, one of the things you keep going back to is desperate people do desperate things.
Right.
And so how do we as consumers guarantee that we're going to say, yeah, it's not right for children to have their lives destroyed in order for us to have a cheap candy bar?
You mentioned in passing earlier something about, I think, one of your children who's really envious of, I suppose, his peers who get to eat. I don't remember what they were, Snickers or Milky Way,
whatever, was his obsession.
Are there some commercial producers who do better than others? I mean, like, in your mind, should we be, in a sense, as consumers, if we share this concern, mm-hmm. are there certain companies where we really should be avoiding their product in protest of their practices? Or, generally speaking, across the board, are we talking about really serious disinterest in this in this issue?
For the average consumer, it is complicated, because chocolate isn't just a chocolate bar. It's what's in your ice cream. It's the chocolate that comes in the cookies you buy. So it is, it's a complicated thing. You may not see the company name that you associate with chocolate on an ice cream, but it's going to have the
Oreos or whatever.
Right. It's still going to have the cheap chocolate. I'm not sure what I'm allowed to say on air here, because I don't want to get you guys in trouble. One of the best companies when it comes to making improvements is Guittard. If you are looking for something you can buy chocolate chips from, somebody you can get in your grocery store, as a company that has made massive strides in improving their supply line, they are one of the best. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right. I hope I am. They're out of San Francisco, and they have been – they were always a big name in the confectioner's world, in people that craft chocolates. But – they've also got now extensive lines of chocolate bars that they have single origin sourced from good providers that they've guaranteed are fair trade, that sort of thing. They've got them now, and they're readily available. In fact, for your listeners, if there's anybody that is concerned about soy lecithin, a lot of people are trying to avoid soy altogether, and when they see that in a chocolate bar, they get panicked. Guittard is one of the few that has been using sunflower lecithin instead of soy. And so you're getting an entirely different product that hopefully might – those that have allergies to soy or something like that, they can go there for that. And it's one of the few that is reasonably, it's more achievably priced for the average consumer. There's lots of really higher end organic chocolate bars and things like that. For them, Guittard, and it's a very good quality chocolate too. I use their stuff in some of my products. They're a really good company with a really good social ethic when it comes to that. They've made progress.
Right. Well, it got me wondering. I mean, that I try to think of some of the, and I'm not particularly inclined to consume these kind of things, but you think of some of the really fancy things that one pays a lot of money for, like Godiva chocolates.
Yes.
Or I think of the best chocolate I ever had in my life was chocolate that I purchased in Switzerland while choir tour. But should we assume, because it has a steep price attached, that somehow this is maybe chocolate that's been procured? You're shaking your head vigorously. So.
No, unfortunately. Most of the time when we pay a high price for chocolate, the chocolate has a reputation. And so when you look at the market prices of chocolates, Godiva's come way down from when I first had a Godiva chocolate. A boss had given it to me for, you know, Secretary's Day, and I was totally unaware of what this company was. And everybody's like, oh, my gosh, he got you Godiva. And I'm like, okay, what's Godiva? It was super expensive back then. That would have been in 90-something. Now it's dropped a lot in price, and you start to see it in Kohl's. You see it in grocery stores and stuff. So it's reputation that determines a lot of that price point. So, no, Godiva is not clean.
So if one is interested in purchasing chocolate that circumvents this kind of nightmarish chain that we've been talking about, one of the possibilities is procuring sweet impact products, which you yourself create from cocoa that is certified as circumventing these child labor practices and other concerns that people might have. Explain to our listeners where you used to do this production, because I asked you if this was in your home, and of course it's not, because you need a certified, approved kitchen in which to do this. Where did you begin, and where are you now in terms of where you do this?
That's actually a challenging thing for anybody who's starting up a food business finds this out very quickly. If you're going to do it legally, it's challenging, because you need space, and there isn't a lot of it. I started in Halo Kitchen, which is, if you're familiar with Racine, Halo is their enormous, wonderful, it's a center, but it's also a giant organization that really is working in Racine to combat homelessness, to work with childcare, all kinds of really good things. And they have a big commercial kitchen that they let people rent out space in. It's called an incubator kitchen. If you look that up, you find out that some cities have some good options for that. Basically, a small business can go in. The state will license you to use that facility. And the facility itself is regularly inspected and licensed by the state. And you rent it by the hour, usually. And they will give you space to store your product, space to store your equipment, and things like that. But that was up in Racine, and I live in Kenosha proper. So it was a bit of a hike. And also because my business model is so weird, very non-traditional, it was starting to become too expensive. So we got a little desperate, and I started brainstorming. And my husband, if he's listening, will say, yes, honey, I told you so. He started listing out places. You need to call this place. You need to call this place.
For possible alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Because it was a matter of finding a restaurant or something that was already licensed to possibly let me use their space. And so the first place I contacted was Frank's Diner. It's close to our area. Chris Schwartz had been our alder person for a while. And I was terrified to go in and ask because they are like this icon of Kenosha. And I'm this little tiny thing.
Well, and you think of the typical restaurant, especially a popular place, as being really, really busy. And it's hard to imagine we'd love you to come in with your stuff and use our kitchen. I mean, I can see how you'd be very reluctant to even pose the question.
Well, yeah, and most restaurants are busy from early in the morning until late at night. So the idea of getting a space is just non-existent.
But Frank's is open for breakfast and lunch?
Yes, right. And so they're closed by 1 or 12:30 every day. And so by the time they've finally gotten cleared out, it's about 4:35, and I can come in then. And it's been challenging because if you've ever been in Frank's, it's packed to the rafters in terms of their own equipment, their own supplies. It's not a big place. But they let me have – I've got room for two big tubs so that I've got most of my supplies in, and the rest gets carted back and forth. And then I'm able to cook while they're not there.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's worked.
It's worked very, very well. So we have just a couple of minutes left, but I want to give you a chance to just explain the kinds of things that you create that people can purchase.
Okay. Well, initially we started out with what we called fudge back then. We're calling it naked truffles now. And so that was our flat out, that's been our traditional product that we've made. We've sold that for 3 years. After I took the chocolatier course, the goal was to be able to provide things that would be healthier for folks, things that are lower in sugar, things that are more of the pure chocolate. So I do bonbons that are filled. I brought you a coconut lime cream with a dark chocolate shell from Ecuador. There's a peanut butter cup that's made with all natural peanut butter, and you make an emulsion of white chocolate and peanut butter and tuck it in there, and everything's all natural. I do a bourbon salted caramel that gets used in all sorts of things. It is the base for my version of a turtle, pecan caramel clusters. And then I also do just naked bourbon salted caramels and dipped in dark chocolate or milk chocolate. And I also do then solid chocolates that are dark chocolates that usually are either plain or they have inclusions such as dried peach and ginger in one of them and some salted pecans in others. So that people have some options if they're really trying to use chocolate as the treat that is not majorly dangerous to their blood sugar level.
Right, right. A little more reasonable in terms of some of those numbers. Mm-hmm. How long does it take for you to create a given something? Like, for instance, one of the treats you brought here, we're talking about hours, days, months? I mean, how long does it take for you to produce what you produce?
Well, right now I'm using such a small production that it does take longer. The dark chocolates would be, the solid ones would be an easier way, shorter term thing. It takes me probably about 20 minutes to hand temper chocolate and get it into workable temperature. And then molds get filled and I bang out probably about, I'm trying to remember what my mold has. I think it's 30 in the mold that I use for the heart ones. So you've got 30 that get direct poured, the inclusions get put in. That probably takes me to do those. 30 of them takes about an hour to an hour and a half if you include wrapping and everything.
Wow.
So The fudge is faster, generally speaking. I can bang that out pretty quickly. I do that in 5-pound batches. Mm. So,
you donate a significant portion of all the money that comes in to two different organizations. Quickly, tell our listeners about those two organizations.
The first and primary one is CAREER. They're the one I am most proud to be affiliated with. They are a rehoming and rehabilitation facility within the Ivory Coast. They're the only one of its kind, working specifically with kids that they are able to get out of trafficking, find out who their parents are, find out what country they came from. Sometimes it's a battle just language-wise. You know, kids come in and they do not speak the typical French of maybe the Ivory Coast primary language. So they have to work with that. But they're also, one of the biggest things they're doing is working with the governments in the countries surrounding and in the Ivory Coast, educating who the traffickers are, helping people know what to look for if it's a bad situation, helping the local police in those countries, the border towns, know what to look for. So they're very much an activist organization as well as this rehabilitation facility.
Right. So you donate to them directly then.
Yes.
And also to CAMFED, which is what kind of organization?
CAMFED Ghana. CAMFED's been known for a while, but the one in Ghana specifically has been committed to mentoring and educating of young girls and women to help them be prepared to be leaders in their communities. Girls' education is the big passion of CAMFED. But the one in Ghana specifically has really found, and this seems to be true in almost every country, young women who grow up to be leaders in their community, set policy, set legislation. They work hard to raise up the lives of women and children in their communities, and it has made a profound difference. So I'm absolutely passionate about women in leadership and girls being educated. So that's why I've got those two.
Terrific. So if people want more information, they should visit your beautiful website and tell them what that address is.
It's www.sweetimpactfudge.com.
One big long word, sweetimpactfudge.com.
Yes.
Christy Wilson is responsible for it. Christy Wilson, this has been fascinating. And congratulations on this undertaking and the success that you've enjoyed and the difference that you are making. And we wish you nothing but further success as you continue in this important work.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. We remind you that you can find the Morning Show archive on our website, wgtd.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Faldudo, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Faldudo played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional